This is the second taped interview with Peter McMillan in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 16th of the 12th, 2002, with the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. So you've been talking about, obviously, being sent off to wireless air gunners. Could we talk about what that involved?
Well, it was quite a long session. It was, I think, pretty close to 3 months. We were into what they call the WAG school in Ballarat, and the first month or so, apart from square bashing, just as we did at Summers, we had to sit down and learn the intricacies of how radios worked, both transmitters and receivers. And they had very, very old sets for us to work on, an RT-1080 and a T-1083, and I don't know what the radio was, but they had huge valves, which would have been about nearly a foot or 8 inches high and a good 2 inches or so in diameter. They were big. And these fitted into a box which fitted into the aircraft. Whereabouts, I don't know, and the ones we trained on. I'll come back to that in a minute. But we spent hours and hours and hours being lectured to by a marvellous old boy who we call KNI. He was called KNI because that was his call sign. Da-da-da, da-da-da, did it, KNI. And he took us through all sorts of wonderful electronic wizardry that went on inside these radios. Now, I can't go into the pros and cons of that at the moment because it's so long ago I can't remember. But I do remember that particular course involved a very stringent effort in physics. Now, I've never done physics in my life. And this was a condensed version that we had in the time that we were at Ballarat. I finished up at the end of the course, third on the actual course, and there must have been 30 or 40 of us on the course. Two of them were very high up in mathematics, so they did very well indeed. The other thing that we had to do was Morse code, and we spent hours and hours learning to send and receive. Now the Morse code that we used was a buzzer type, and it was not a clacker type that they use on the ground between the postmaster general and all that sort of thing. These were proper Morse code that went out over the ether. At the end of that time at Ballarat, I could send at 28 words a minute and receive at around about 28 to 30 words a minute, which was the highest on the course. All these things led towards me at the finish of the course, not being anything else but a wireless air gunner. Part of the course involved learning to use the radios in the air, and we had Douglas DC aircraft, DC-2 aircraft, which were old They're pretty old types, and they were fitted up inside with half a dozen receiving and transmitting sets and a chair that you sat at and worked. They also had another thing we had to be involved in called radio telephone. This was a rather low frequency, and for it to take place, they had to lower an aerial out of the aircraft, went down a tube, and the end was weighted with I don't know how many lead weights, but an awful lot. And it was about 50, pretty close to 50 to 100 feet long. And it was on a thing like a fishing reel. We'd put the end of the aerial down the tube and then very carefully unwind the reel. It didn't have a proper brake on it. If it started to run away, you put your hand on it to slow it down. When it got to the end of all the radio going out, it clicked into position, and then you're right, and you could sit down, and you could actually talk to the ground or talk to other aircraft. The other work that we did with transmitting and receiving, we had to estimate a frequency, set it on the transmitter, and then transmit that frequency to a particular station. Now, this could have been anywhere in the state of Victoria. One of their favourite places was Laverton. I became quite proficient at doing this, so did most of my other mates, and we had talks in Morse code with these stations. I don't know how many hours we did in this. I think we did 14 odd hours in the air working on this particular thing. Looking at my log book, it called them WT exercises, wireless telegraphy exercises, listening watches, where you had to listen what was being sent and write it down. Mainly it was that sort of thing, listening watches and WT exercises. We flew on an average about between an hour and an hour and a half, which was a fair long time. And I can remember the very first trip when we went up, and it was my first trip in an aircraft. There were 10 of us in the cabin, plus the unfortunate airman who looked after us. And I think of the 10, 8 were violently ill. I don't know why I wasn't. It was probably because I was used to not being seasick. But the stink inside the cabin was something that you had to really imagine. That was our very first trip, which was a listening watch. I've got it down in my logbook as being satisfactory, but whether it was or not, I don't know. The other things that we had to do at Ballarat were physical exercises, and these involved cross-country runs. The normal cross-country run was around about 5 miles, which is quite a long one. Four of my friends who came from Elder Smith's and Dalgetty's, we found that on the cross-country course there was a very nice little ancient pub called the Bunch of Grapes, which was on the run. And we used to quietly peel off from the mob and go and sit in the Bunch of Grapes and drink beer, which came in a keg on the counter. And when we saw the mob coming back again, we'd surreptitiously join them and go back to base. That was our cross-country running. It was afterwards, when we were on the ship going over to the Middle East, we found that the warrant officer in charge of recreation, sport and all the rest of it was our warrant officer on the ship. And he got hold of us one day and he said, "How did you enjoy your cross-country running?" And we said, "Oh, it was great." And he said, "Yeah, I'll bet it was. And you probably enjoyed it at the bunch of grapes too." He knew what we were doing all along. He was a good bloke. I think it's very difficult to explain exactly what went on at Ballarat. It was a time when we got to know each other and worked more or less in groups as a team, as teams. Most of us were friends from Perth and we seemed to stick together. One fella in particular, Kevin Stewart, was my great mate, and his parents lived in Melbourne, and whenever we had leave, we'd go off to Melbourne and stay with them. It was probably one of the things we always looked forward to, was going on leave from Ballarat. We used to have leave fairly regularly. I wish I knew how long we'd been there. I've not got it down in the logbook all the time, but it was quite a few months.
With all of this training going on, had you been hearing what was going on in the outside world in relation to how the war was going?
Yes, we used to hear results of what was happening and where Hitler was going and what he was doing.
What were some of the highlights of that?
I can't honestly recall that. It's very difficult to...
We've been talking about the period of early 41. What of who your enemy might be? Had you heard anything about where you might be going to be sent?
No. We hadn't heard anything at all then. It wasn't until the final postings came when we went to air gunnery school that we knew what was going to happen.
What was your final posting to be?
The Middle East. Yeah. I was lucky. There were 30 of us posted to the Middle East out of all these courses. That included navigators, radio operators and pilots.
You've been mentioning the training, obviously, in relation to sending and receiving with radio. What is the actual gunnery part?
Well, that came on after the wireless operating effort from number one WAG school at Ballarat. We were then posted to the gunnery squadron at Evans Head. It was number one AGS, I think, but it was called the gunnery squadron. And this was a very, very different kettle of fish to playing around with wireless. We were introduced to firing guns from the air, but we didn't have turrets that were mechanically operated. They were very ancient guns that fired out of the back of the aircraft up top, very like an old Lewis gun. And they used to jam and the first fight that we were up, there were two of us in the back, and he was violently sick, and I wasn't, because I put my head out into the slipstream and left it there. Again, the smell and stink was bloody awful. The first flight we had was 60 minutes, I think, which was a long while. And we had, the first thing that happened was, in my logbook I can see, unsatisfactory, number two stoppage, whatever that was, cleared and fired, landed after an hour. The next flight was satisfactory, and I managed to fire 97 rounds. That was in 45 minutes. Now, firing... They had great big sand patches, And next door to it was a tower made of pretty thick concrete and bricks. And the blokes used to be inside the tower watching where your shots landed. How we never hit the tower, I don't know. But we were supposed to hit that patch. And probably of the 97 rounds I fired, probably only 10 or 11 would have hit the patch, because we were going along at 150 odd miles an hour. It was a matter of judgment. Later on, I got more expert and was able to lie off, as they say, and instead of firing at the thing, is to start firing over there. And I managed to get a lot of good results from that. You've still got percentage results. The next thing that we had to do was to learn to fire underneath the aircraft. They had a hole underneath and you fired down. That was a bit easier, I suppose. And then the other thing we fired at were drogues. And the drogues were pulled by another aircraft. I don't know if it's mentioned here. This is the OTU. With my friend up in the aircraft firing at a drone, he very carefully managed to shoot the wire that towed the drone. And that created bloody difficulty. As far as I'm concerned, I could have killed him, because we were sent back out into the scrubby, swampy country to retrieve the drogue. That was a very naughty thing to do. I used to enjoy firing at the drogue, because I knew that my similar rounds used to hit it, but I never managed to cut the wire. I think the time at the gunnery squadron was more active than anything we'd ever been on. When we'd finished in the afternoon, it was stand down, and you could go into Evans Head and do what you liked. With my friend from down the southwest, we used to retire to the pub and get hold of two flagons of beer. They dispensed the beer into these big flagons. Then we used to go down to the beach and go fishing, or we'd go onto the rocks and sit down with our beer and a knife, and we'd prize oysters off the rock and have oysters and beer. It was luxury, really. It was lovely. The actual Evans Head water was really beautiful. It was a beach very similar in a way to what got at Cottesloe. I think that we were there for, I can't even remember that now, from the 7th of April to around about May.
During that time, obviously, the recent Crete had occurred. What were your hearings of stories about the success or lack of success?
We were hearing not too nice things about the aircraft that were being used. And one of the things that I would emphasise is that the aircraft we were flying in at Evans Head, we were lucky to be alive. They were fairy battles. And they used the fairy battles in France, and they got hell knocked out of them. The fairy battle was a single-engined aircraft with the pilot flying and then a wireless operator and an air gunner in the back. Absolute death traps. And in our time at Evans Head, they had one praying that I can remember with these battles. Nobody was hurt, but the aircraft was a wipe-off. But the engines were more or less in a clapped-out state, and they had to be continuously serviced all the time. And these were the aircraft that Great Britain sent to fight the Messerschmitts and all the others. Terrible. I don't know what the other aircraft were they had at that time. We didn't have them out here. We only had the Ansons and the Hudsons and the Boomerangs and the whatever they were. The others didn't have much here. We had heard rumours about what was happening in other parts of the world. Japan seemed to be making its presence felt, but it didn't affect us in any way at this stage. We had heard that the aircraft we would be flying in, if we got overseas, would be maybe a little bit better than the battles, but we didn't really know what we were going to encounter.
What were the planes that were hoped to be flown?
We had heard about Wellington's bombers, big bombers, and we reckon they sound pretty terrific. We'd heard about Blenheim's. They were a light bomber, and we thought that they sounded pretty good, but then we heard how they got shot up and shot down and all sorts of things happened to them. The Wellingtons seemed to be the ones, but there were other aircraft too we heard about that rather shook us. Bombays, and I can't remember the other ones. I can't remember them. They were aircraft that were more or less held together with strings and all sorts of other things. They were amazing old aircraft. We hadn't got much of a clue as to what was happening overseas, though. It was only what we used to hear on the radio, and that was never very good. We heard how France had fallen and the decimation that was had in Poland and places like that, how England was being bashed around. It sounded pretty grim. All that we wanted to do is to get over there and have a crack at the people who were doing it. Shows how naive we were. It was a big adventure.
I'm interested to discuss that, because obviously there seemed to be a glimmer of hope in the Middle East.
There was, but we didn't hear that. We didn't hear that. We just heard that they were fighting like hell. And one of our friends was over there, Daniel McDaniel. Danny unfortunately died from a burst appendix, but he used to write back to his brother and tell him what was happening, and used to say it was pretty grim and they were having a hell of a fight.
Did anyone discuss the risks that one was taking being a wireless air gunner?
No. Never entered our heads. Couldn't happen to us. Amazing. Wasn't till later when we learnt a thing or two that we realised how dicey things could be. We'd get into an aircraft like these ferry battles and put all our faith in the pilots, who put their faith in the ground crew, who crossed their fingers, I suppose, I don't know. It was at the gunnery squadron that we were assessed as to what our future would be in the Air Force, gradings and that sort of thing. And I was down cleaning guns one day, and I was in my dirty old overalls, and I was greased in my hands and pretty dirty. And an airman, we call them Irks, came over from the office and said, "McMillan, you're wanted in the office." I said, right. So I got up and I had a dirty bit of rag that I kept in my hip pocket, and I wiped my hands and tried to clean them up with a bit of kerosene, put the rag back in my pocket, and then ambled over to the office. When I got there, the Irk in charge of the office said, go in there and sit down and wait. So I sat down and waited. I thought, what the bloody hell have I done? And after a while, another friend of mine came out of the office, dressed up beautifully, and went out the door. And then I was called in. I was told to sit down. And in front of me were three, to me, senior officers, a squadron leader and the OC of the gunnery squadron, and another bloke with two stripes on his shoulder, who was Flight Louis. And they interviewed me. I didn't know what I was being interviewed for. Nobody told me. I hadn't got a clue. And in the end, they said, right, McMillan, that's it. You can go. So out I went. And when I got outside, the Irk at the counter said, right, you can go back to cleaning your guns. So I went back to cleaning the guns. It wasn't later that I found out that I'd been pulled up there as possible officer material. Thank Christ I never was made an officer, because all the blokes that were made officers ended up in the Pacific, and none came back. My report said had been officer material, but is now recommended that he be a sergeant, and the thing underneath said that he was untidy but intelligent. Now, that was because I'd been called up in my dirty old overalls now. Hadn't got a clue. Yeah, it's amazing. The postings came from Evans Head in May 1941. We were posted to the embarkation depot over in Perth. We were given 3 weeks leave, which I spent back in Perth with the family, and then back to the Esplanade, where we cooled our heels, and to keep us occupied, they used to send us on route marches. And one of the route marches took us around to the Swan Brewery. And we used to route march to the Swan Brewery, then go into the Swan Brewery and spend half the day there. They used to imbibe us beer, and it was really very nice. And then we'd stagger back to the embarkation depot. We got to know the Swan Brewery very well. We were in the embarkation depot, and then one day they said, right, gather all your belongings together, you're going overseas. And we were put onto the Zephyr, which was one of the boats that used to go from Perth to Rottnest. We were all poured onto the Zephyr and taken out and put on board the Queen Elizabeth. On board the Queen Elizabeth, there were AIF troops in abundance. They came from the eastern states, plus a whole heap that were put on board from WA. And we set off on our trip to the Middle East. I've got a bit of information in the back of my book.
What date have we been looking at, roughly?
I'll try. Number one ITS summers, 10th of the 7th to the 28th of the 9th, 1940. Number one WAGS Ballarat, 1st to the 10th, 1940, to the 1st of the 4th, 41. Number one BAGS, that's the Air Gunnery Evans Head, 8th of the 4th, 41, to the 3rd of the 5th, 41. And then, from then on, we went to embarkation depot from the 3rd of the 5th, or no, it would have been the 6th of the 5th, 41, till, it doesn't say here.
The information I have is that it would have been in June 41 that you would have been sent overseas to go to the Middle East.
Yeah, that would be right.